From NPR and WBUR, I'm Eric Westervelt.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. State and local officials around the country are reacting today to the Trump administration's actions on transgender students. Yesterday, the administration announced it would roll back an Obama policy aimed at stopping discrimination against transgender students. The most controversial aspect of that policy was that it directed schools to allow transgender students to use bathrooms and locker rooms that correspond with their gender identity. Dominic Holden is LGBT reporter for BuzzFeed News. He joins us now. Hi, Dominic.
Hello, Jeremy.
And tell us, first of all, what this ruling means for states and local communities. What options do they have?
So there was already an injunction in place since last August that suspended this guidance for the time being while the case is litigated in federal court. What this says is that the guidance issued under Obama is no longer the position of the federal government, and that states and local school districts have the authority to decide what sort of policy they will have for transgender students. And what we've already started to hear from a number of school districts is that they do intend to maintain their policy. They intend to follow state laws that provide for protections for transgender students, allowing them to use facilities that match their gender identity, and that they will continue to enforce and ban discrimination under local policy.
And have you also heard from states or localities that have gone the other direction?
The first one that I've heard from is Gloucester County in Virginia, which is currently involved in a case that's heading to the Supreme Court. In this case, the county school board has a policy that bans transgender students from using facilities that match their gender identity, and they have been at loggerheads with the ACLU and a transgender student. They are supporting Trump's decision here, and they say that this will allow them to examine the underlying legal question, which is whether or not existing federal civil rights law for education, often referred to as Title IX as it refers to sex discrimination, extends to gender identity, thereby protecting transgender students, or if it doesn't. They argue it doesn't, and they support this new position of the White House.
We are already hearing about some disagreement within the Trump administration on this issue, that Attorney General Jeff Sessions and Education Secretary Betsy DeVos were not on the same page here. DeVos issued a statement yesterday saying that we owe all students a commitment to ensure they have access to a learning environment that is free of discrimination, bullying, and harassment. And she also said it was an issue best dealt with at the state and local level. But what are you hearing about how they made this decision within the Trump administration to pull back on this Obama administration order?
What I've heard from people that I'm talking to, and this is reflected in some of the reportings we've seen in the New York Times, is that Jeff Sessions, the attorney general, had really pushed to draw back this guidance and perhaps change the government's position, and that Betsy DeVos, the education secretary, had resisted and raised concerns about what would happen for transgender students. I mean, ultimately, there is a question that this administration is going to have to answer, and that is whether existing civil rights laws that ban discrimination on the basis of sex apply to transgender people as well. Ultimately, the guidance that they issued yesterday did not address that question. But it's really at the heart of this. And if they do believe that sex discrimination does not cover transgender people, that has big implications, because we also have, in addition to Title IX from 1972, we also have the Civil Rights Act from 1964 that banned sex discrimination in the workplace. If the Trump administration changes its position in terms of this question in schools, it seems almost inevitable it would change that position for workplaces, and that could impact hundreds of thousands of Americans in a wide range of settings, not just public schools, but private workplaces.
Dominic, does it feel to you, as somebody who covers these issues all the time, like public opinion is changing quickly on this issue?
You know, for a long time, the big LGBT question in America was whether or not same-sex couples should be allowed to get married. And even among many social conservatives who I speak to, they say that settled law, they don't want to have that fight anymore. Now they talk about issues like religious freedom for bakers who don't want to bake a cake for a same-sex wedding, or their objections to trans people using, restrooms that match their gender identity. You know, I think that many of these conservatives are pulling back their line in the sand, as the sort of starting point for a lot of Americans is that transgender people and LGB Americans are already protected from discrimination.
That's Dominic Holden, who is LGBT reporter for BuzzFeed News. Dominic, thanks.
Thank you for having me.
Well, that directive from the president was a great sign for social conservatives. There had been some questions about where the president was going to come down on some of those key issues. Right after he won the election, Trump said he wouldn't try to fight the Supreme Court's 2015 ruling that legalized gay marriage everywhere. And throughout his campaign, there were doubts about whether he was actually against legal abortions. In general, Trump has had his trouble mixing with the different branches of traditional conservatism, which makes this weekend's Conservative Political Action Conference so interesting. It's the biggest annual meeting for conservatives, and NPR's Don Gagne is there at the Gaylord National Resort and Convention Center just outside Washington, D.C. Don, welcome.
Hey, glad to be here.
So, a little context. Tell us about CPAC and what the scene is like there today.
We'll have more than 10,000 conservative activists here. It is, as you said, the biggest such gathering. It happens every year. They've been doing it since 1974, and it's like part campaign rally, especially so on election years. So this one might be just a little more muted along those lines, but part kind of, you know, policy forum or salon, part carnival, especially if you wander through the exhibit area downstairs where you, Eric, you can get a beer koozie for just about any conservative cause you can imagine if you... There. It's also, you know, part mixer. You have all kinds of college students here, mostly here, you know, either with some help paying for the registration fees or on scholarship. And it's just the place that you have to be if you're a conservative activist in America.
Well, let's listen to White House advisor Kellyanne Conway. She spoke this morning about Trump's campaign and how his message fits with the message of CPAC.
He's sort of the first candidate of his type, that non-politician, true outsider who's coming to shake up the system. That seems to me to be very relatable and resonant with CPAC.
Don, Ronald Reagan had some of that outsider allure and appeal, and he was embraced by traditional conservatives. He won the CPAC straw poll, presidential straw poll, for many years. But Trump certainly had a rockier time dovetailing with conservatives, correct?
Yes, and you know, that outsider comparison is okay, but you don't want to go too far in making the Trump-Reagan comparison at this point. Reagan spoke at the very first CPAC, and he is really the patron saint of this organization. He or Barry Goldwater. It was Goldwater's campaign for president in 1964 that was one of the things that encouraged a group of conservatives to kind of. That we got the first CPAC conference, but CPAC attendees even will tell you that while they knew exactly where Ronald Reagan was coming from on things, they're still kind of keeping a wary eye on President Trump. They like a lot of what they've seen since the election, the Supreme Court pick, the cabinet picks. But it's not quite that full-on embrace.
They might not fully trust him. Let's listen to a clip of Dan Schneider, the executive director of the American Conservative Union. He gave a speech today called "The Alt-Right Ain't Right at All."
They are not part of us. They are anti-Semites. They are racists. They are sexists.
Don, we know that Milo Yiannopoulos, the alt-right star, I guess you could say fading star, was originally invited to speak this weekend, but that invite was rescinded. Talk about what place at the table the more extreme parts of the right have at this weekend's meeting, if they do.
They are not front and center, which is not to say that they're not represented here. I mean, there's a pretty good sized booth for Breitbart News, and that's certainly a news organization that the alt-right embraces and supports. But it is, you know, conservatives from across the spectrum here, and a good number of them kind of old school mainstream conservatives. You've got evangelical conservatives. You've got the like. But we will, hear from the likes of Steve Bannon, the Breitbart publisher and now top White House strategist. So that's that's, you know, that's there, and you can't ignore that. But to say there's like a real alt-right presence here, you couldn't say that at all.
Don, from a policy perspective, what's the highest priority there this weekend? Is immigration, finding a way to repeal the Affordable Care Act, what?
Those are certainly big things. Obviously, tax reform. You hear all of those things, but ultimately, this is not a policy conference. You know, it's almost a bond as anything else. And they will talk policy, and we'll hear about all of those things. But ultimately, all of that stuff's going to be driven by the White House and the Congress.
All right. Well, we'll be keeping an eye on it. You'll be reporting on it from CPAC, NPR political correspondent Don Gagne. Thanks so much, Don.
All right. My pleasure.
President Donald Trump has made three trips to Palm Beach, Florida since his inauguration last month. He has been immersed in the ostentatious social scene of Palm Beach since at least 1985, when he bought the historic Mar-a-Lago estate, which he later turned into a private club. But now, as the home of the so-called Winter White House, Palm Beach is taking on a whole new relevance. And few know more about the social scene there than Shannon Donnelly, who is society editor for the Palm Beach Daily News, known around town as the Shiny Sheet. Shannon, you've been covering high society in Palm Beach for more than two decades. For those who haven't been there, what's Palm Beach all about?
Well, it's all about sunshine and money and just living the good life.
But how is it different from Miami or Fort Lauderdale or some of the other places around there?
Well, it's extremely insulated. It's an island. It's only accessible by three bridges, which are heavily patrolled with television cameras, traffic cameras that have a direct feed to the police department. And it's the sort of place where people who are very, very rich go for getaways.
I remember during the campaign, there was a night when Donald Trump was holding a rally in Palm Beach and Hillary Clinton was holding a rally in West Palm Beach. What's the difference between the two places?
Well, West Palm Beach is a large metropolitan area, part of Palm Beach County, which is actually bigger than the whole state of Rhode Island. And it's very diverse and spread out and primarily skews 40 to 75.
And Donald Trump has been in Palm Beach since 1985 when he bought Mar-a-Lago and turned it into a private club in 1995. How does he fit in to the scene there?
Well, he fits in now much more comfortably than in 1985. You know, he was perceived as sort of this upstart, brash New Yorker who thought he was going to come to town and you know, do whatever he wanted. And this town is very preservation-minded, which I think is often used as an excuse just to exclude people. And he's, you know, had a hard time. The people who live in the neighborhood that of Mar-a-Lago didn't want him to develop anything. But he's a very smart businessman and very strategic, and he got his way.
And he's had a couple of fights with the city, right?
He's had more than a couple of fights with the city. Sometimes the city won, like, over the flag thing. And
the flag thing is he wanted to build a really tall flagpole, and they told him that that was against the ordinances.
Yes. Well, first he did it in Santa Barbara or one of those places, someplace where he put this huge flag up, which was against the town code, and then the town got after him and he got all of this publicity. It was just all over the newspapers. And I said to one of my colleagues, you watch, he's going to do the same thing here. And sure enough, you know, he decides arbitrarily to build this gigantic flag, which is in an FAA landing zone. So there were also federal considerations there, and got a lot of publicity and got to call everybody un-American. But eventually he and the town settled and he has a large flag there, but not as large as he wanted.
Well, and you mentioned FAA. Mm-hmm. We met somebody named Jerry Powers last year who used to publish Trump Magazine, and he said that Trump used to hire him back in the day to bring people up to Mar-a-Lago to have huge parties, and that the reason was that Trump wanted leverage to get the flights to stop flying over Mar-a-Lago.
Well, as I said, he's very strategic.
Do you remember that, though? Do you remember him doing that?
I remember him having parties at Mar-a-Lago, but bringing people up from Miami is not any reason for, you know, my newspaper, which is strictly the town of Palm Beach, to cover something. I believe it happened, but I was not there for it.
And by the way, Trump has called you a good writer, tough and fair. Has he gone after you?
Many times. We've certainly had our differences, although I am a good writer and tough but fair, so I agree with that. Someone asked me to describe our relationship. I said it's like being in a carpool with somebody you don't really like, but they've got really good air conditioning. So, I mean, we have to get along for me to do my job, and, you know, he has to get along with me for his club to you know, be what he wants it to be. So we have an understanding.
Describe a Mar-a-Lago party to us, because I know you've been to many.
Okay. Well, we have to sort of break up the venues. There's the big, you know, gala balls, which take place in the ballroom that Donald built as an addition to the property. Then there's the smaller parties that take place in the original house itself. So if you're in most of the ones that I go to are the big charity balls. So it starts with a cocktail reception, usually around the pool. There's usually some kind of music around the pool, maybe a string quartet. I've been to parties where there was a full symphony orchestra. There's several bars set up, you know, waiters, waitresses circulating with hors d'oeuvres. And then you move up some tiled stairs and then down some tiled stairs to the Grand Ballroom, which is a replica of the Hall of Mirrors at Versailles. So it's all gold, gilt, and it's, you know, beautiful mirrors and you know, marble floor. And that's where you have dinner and you're dancing. Of course, there's always speeches, thank you, big donors. And when you go home, there's usually a little coffee bar outside waiting for you while you wait for the valet to bring you your car. And you get a little bag from, you know, Tiffany or someplace as your table gift.
So Mar-a-Lago has about 500 members. Give us a sense of who they are.
I tell people, they ask, well, is it a good club? And I tell people, the best club in town is the one you can get into. So, you know, to the people who are members of Mar-a-Lago, it's the best place in town because it's where they could belong without going through an extremely thorough and sometimes embarrassing vetting process where you have to ask, you know, six members if they'll be willing to sponsor you. Then you have to submit your income tax records and you have to, you know, get references from, you know, previous clubs. You don't have to do that at Mar-a-Lago. If you can afford the membership fee and there's room for you, you can get in.
And they've doubled the price of being a member there, right?
Yes. After the election, they doubled the price to $200,000 for an initiation fee. Which, by the way, is refundable when you terminate your membership. But that really didn't affect – I think there were probably only 10 or 11 memberships left anyway. So, you know, I mean, so yay, they got, you know, $200,000 times 10 or 11. But, yeah, it's not like there's going to be, you know, 500 more members at $200,000 per.
And the people that are members are – a lot of them CEOs of companies, right?
Mm-hmm. Sure. Yeah.
Do they have special access to the president?
I don't know. Well, I was there Saturday night for an event, and I have to tell you, it was much easier to talk to him when he wasn't president. His entrance, his egress, all accompanied by a slew of Secret Service men. When he sits down at a table, the Secret Service surrounds the table. You can't really approach it. Sometimes he'll get up and work the room, which – you know, you could see the distress on the look of the Secret Service agents' faces because they do not like that. But, you know, I would say if you play golf with him, sure, you have access. If you're just there having dinner, probably not. You could see him, you can wave to him, but you're not going to be able to talk to him.
How have the people of Palm Beach felt about Trump now that he's president? We've heard stories about the fact that some of the businesses are really frustrated by the disruptions when he goes to Mar-a-Lago. But how are people thinking about him now?
Well, you know, he's the president. And Palm Beach is a very Republican community. But, you know, whether you voted for him or not, he's the president. And this is where he decides to spend his weekends. Well, you know, we have to live with it. JFK was here all the time when he was president. Of course, I don't remember that. I think the people that live south of Mar-a-Lago – it's an inconvenience for them. But what are you going to do? I mean, you can – actually, I think he's thinking about building a helipad to bring him in from the airport, which may ease traffic a little bit. But we'll see what happens.
But you still got the issue of the airport nearby, the private airport that has to shut down when he's
yes,
there, right?
Yes. The Lantana Airport, yes, has to shut down. And that's really an issue. You know, they close the entire airport to all other air traffic when the president is getting ready to leave.
Presidents in general, when they go on vacation, they tend to be in these little insulated worlds. We know that President Obama and President Clinton would go to Martha's Vineyard mm-hmm. in the summertime, right. and President George W. Bush would go down to Texas, but he was in his compound there.
Right.
Does Donald Trump ever venture out into the city of Palm Beach, or do you, when you go to Mar-a-Lago, do you just stay at Mar-a-Lago?
He tends to stay at Mar-a-Lago. I think I've seen him out in about one time in all the years I've known him, and it was coming out of Tiffany's on Worth Avenue doing some Christmas shopping. You know, he tends to stick to Mar-a-Lago because really, you know, why do you need to leave? You have the beach, you have a spa, you have, fine dining. But he will go to his golf clubs. He does get out to go to his golf clubs.
You just mentioned something that I want to ask you about, mm-hmm. Worth Avenue. Mm-hmm. So the big street in Palm Beach is called Worth Avenue.
Yes, right.
What's that about?
Well, it's sort of like the Rodeo Drive of Palm Beach. It's very high-end retailers. It's Gucci, it's Hermes, it's Chanel, it's Tiffany, it's Van Cleef & Arpels, it's Saks Fifth Avenue. That is the high-end district. They're not really suffering as much because they are close to the Middle Bridge, which is not closed down when the president is in town.
Do you know why it's called Worth Avenue?
Well, it's actually named after Lake Worth. I would like to say it's because
it's not how much are you worth?
Because Cash Avenue was already taken, but yeah. Then no, that's not why it's named after Lake Worth.
Okay. That's Shannon Donnelly, who is society editor for the Palm Beach Daily News, which they call the shiny sheet. And they call that the shiny sheet. Why, Shannon?
Well, because we're printed on very high quality stock. The ladies were complaining years and years ago about the ink rubbing off on their Pratese linens. So we went to a very high quality magazine stock that does not rub off. You know, you don't have to wear gloves like when you read the New York Times.
Well, Shannon Donnelly, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
This podcast and the following message are sponsored by Blue Apron, knowing that incredible ingredients make incredible meals. They follow the highest quality standards and deliver recipes along with just the right amount of ingredients to make delicious home-cooked meals. New recipes are created each week, so you can customize your recipes each week. Check out this week's menu and get 3 meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/here. You don't have to spend time at the grocery store. Make great meals in under 40 minutes. There's no commitment, so pick what you want at blueapron.com/here.
Budapest is the latest city to end its bid to host the Olympic Games. The Hungarian government pulled its support for the city's attempt to host the 2024 Summer Games yesterday. Budapest is the fourth city to drop its bid, following Boston, Hamburg, and Rome. That leaves only Los Angeles and Paris still in the running. The news comes 6 months after the closing ceremonies of the Summer Games in Rio and stories this week about venues there falling apart and abandoned. Mike Pesca is here now, sports analyst. He hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. Mike, welcome to Here Now.
Hello. Thanks.
So the story in USA Today is that the Olympic Village is a ghost town and the athletes' village is empty in Rio. I mean, what was supposed to happen there?
Well, supposed to happen. I think anyone who looked at it with knowledge of the Olympics in the past could have predicted something along these lines. It's just very predictable, the environmental impact of a lot of these structures, the monetary burden that it would be to a country like Brazil, which, to be fair, when it bid on the Games was in flush economic times, but has since, of course, fallen on hard political and economic times. It was all so very foreseeable. But the Olympics does not care, or at least to be very fair, to bend over backwards like a rhythmic gymnast, to be very, very fair, did not care quite demonstrably for years. Now they say they do. They have a plan for sustainability from 2020 going forward. And Thomas Bach, who is the new president of the Olympics, says that he very much wants venues to be used going forward and not to bankrupt companies. But that has not been the case in the past.
Mike, I mean, it seems like another black eye for the Olympic movement here. I mean, this is a bit shameful that so close after the end of the Games, these places are abandoned and causing economic and environmental problems. Who's to blame here?
Well, I think it's everyone's to blame. It's either the people actually, the Olympic members who actually award the bids and demand that they have extremely expensive per diems and stay in five-star hotels and get treated like grandees. But even if you are one of the members of the Olympic Committee that sees themselves as a reformer, you know, Western Europe or even the United States, do you really stand up and ever say no, not enough? I mean, Los Angeles still has an active bid. So maybe what the Olympics needs is for all the possible nations to host it to go away and to give the message. But of course, that's not going to happen because there will always be someone with a gleam of it in their eye saying, oh, we can do it better than Rio. And maybe Tokyo can. You know, Tokyo is a more developed nation and they have something to prove. But even with Tokyo, there's, you know, just the history of the Olympics. They'd rather build a new stadium than maybe use an existing one and admit, okay, it won't be the state of the art for those couple of weeks, but it also won't bankrupt the host country.
So the structure of the Olympic movement is partly to blame. And with Budapest, the latest city to drop its bid, I mean, do you think the Olympics are in trouble?
I do. I think they definitely need to reform. I think we're seeing a trend where only autocratic countries are putting forward their or raising their hands. So we see Beijing and Almaty, Kazakhstan. I mean, Budapest, if you look at what's going on in Hungary, it's not exactly unautocratic, and even them pulling out. So it's only sort of dictators who will use the Olympics to burnish their country's potential willing to do it, and democracies just don't want the headache. Some do. Tokyo does. Apparently Los Angeles still does, but that is waning.
Budapest. That's Mike Pesca. He hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. Thanks a lot, Mike.
You're welcome.
President Trump's policies on immigration, refugees, and more have prompted millions of people to get off the couch and into the streets.
Shame on Trump! Shame on Trump! Shame on Trump!
But historically, which kinds of protest actions have worked and which have fizzled? L.A. Kaufman has spent decades immersed in progressive causes as a participant, strategist, journalist, and observer, from saving community gardens in New York City to protests against the Iraq War. Her new book is Direct Action, Protest and the Reinvention of American Radicalism. And L.A. Kaufman joins us from New York City. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you so much for having me.
You know, presidents have always faced protesters, but put this moment with President Trump into a wider context historically for us. Seems there are folks getting involved who've never been part of political action before.
Yeah, I mean, there are always, you know, waves that come and go of protest over time. But I think what we're seeing right now is really quite unique and unprecedented. There hasn't ever been a president who's been greeted by so many protests in his first month of office. And the character of the protests has been really extraordinary in their breadth, in their diversity, in the number of unlikely places that they've shown up. We're really seeing something that in decades of observing grassroots movements, I've never quite seen before.
Yeah, hundreds of thousands of people have been involved. There were estimates that more than a million people participated in the Women's March in Washington the day after Trump's inauguration. There were these Not Our President, President's Day protests and many smaller ones. Do you think the protest energy, L.A., is sustainable over time? We're talking about a four-year term at least.
Oh, I don't like the sound of that at least. I mean, obviously you can't stay in crisis mode and at a fever pitch for year after year after year. But I see a lot of people recognizing that this is a long haul and recognizing right now really what the movements are doing together is creating a crisis for the Trump administration and in so doing managing to slow down some of the worst of the harm. I think people understand that it's going to take a lot of different approaches, that it's not going to just be marching in the street. It's going to be the town halls, not just during one winter break, but over and over and over again. I think that the deep sense of fear and concern that people are feeling for the future of our country right now is going to sustain more of this than you might expect.
LA, let's talk about scale a bit. As you point out in your book, Direct Action, the group AIDS Coalition to Unleash Power, or ACT UP, was never about being very big or having tens of thousands take to the streets, but they were incredibly effective. Arguably, they saved millions of lives. Talk about that.
Yeah, I really see ACT UP as the single most effective activist group of the last 40 years because, as you say, the evidence is quite compelling that there are millions of people alive today who would not be if it were not for their work to transform the drug testing and approval process, as well as the way that medications for HIV are distributed. Mm. They were always pretty small, and they were always quite rude and obnoxious. I mean, ACT UP didn't go politely to ask for medications to be approved. People's lives were at stake. The people who were organizing were often themselves very sick and in the last months of their lives. Mm. And they were disruptive. Their graphics were very in-your-face. Everything about them was very polarizing. They created a crisis and they polarized. They also were very smart and they did their research so that when their protests got them access to meetings with government officials, they were very well informed and able to make very specific recommendations about policy changes. So that combination of the outsider and insider, but with the willingness to be bold and persistent, that was the particular combination that worked so powerfully for them and is a model for many other movements to look to.
And ACT UP had a sense that bigger was not necessarily better.
Yeah, there are times when all a big protest does is kind of demonstrate the scale of one's powerlessness. Mm. That's the way a lot of protests felt to me in the late 80s. There were a lot of times when it just felt like you can bring large numbers of people together, but what are you doing but shouting slogans, you know, about changes that are never going to happen. It was particularly sobering. I was very centrally involved in the big protest against the Iraq War in 2003. Mm-hmm. And the contrast between the millions of people who marched in the streets all around the world on every continent and the utter indifference of the Bush administration to those protests was really dispiriting. And it was a lesson to me in thinking about the limits of the mass mobilizing model. It's not always about how many people you can bring out. I mean, that does important political work, but that's not necessarily what brings about change.
Yeah, the 2003 Iraq War invasion protests largely made people feel good, but really had no wider impact.
I mean, they maybe made them feel good on February 15th. By about March 20th, we were all feeling pretty awful once the invasion began. I mean, the feeling better that you're alluding to, I mean, I think that's some of the work that the Women's March did, and I think there was real political power in that. You know, it's not in itself going to change the policies of the Trump administration, but wow, did it make a lot of people feel the collective power of standing together and a sense of possibility, a sense of hope that in fact, if we take action, if we step outside our comfort zones, we can change the direction of this country, not just 4 years from now, but right now.
You mentioned looking at ACT UP and looking at the success metric through a broader historical lens. You talk about in the book about the May Day 1971 protests against the Vietnam War. At the time, it was not well received. It was seen as kind of a dud. It's not that well known today. But you point out that many grassroots lessons came out of that May Day protest. Talk about that.
It was this attempt to shut down the federal government through nonviolent direct action. The slogan was, if the government won't stop the war, the people will stop the government. Hmm. They really did bring somewhere around 25,000 people came and used their bodies and things like newspaper boxes and cars, with deflated tires and whatever else they could put their hands on to blockade the streets of Washington, D.C., to block the bridges leading into town and to try to shut down all business for the day. This was enormously controversial at the time because of how disruptive it was. But it also was incredibly unnerving to the Nixon administration. Here was a nonviolent protest. They couldn't be dismissed as, rioting hooligans. They were really holding to nonviolent discipline. But they were bringing what felt like the specter of revolution right to the doorstep of the White House. Mm. They made something like 7,000 arrests that day, the largest number of arrests in any day in U.S. history. But most importantly, what wasn't visible at the time was the Nixon administration decided they needed to speed up the withdrawal from Vietnam. They didn't want to face that level of unrest again.
And groups such as the Gay Liberation Front and others took some direct action lessons from that day.
Yeah, it was this moment when a bunch of movements that are now kind of called identity politics movements, the Gay Liberation Movement, the Women's Liberation Movement, the Black Power Movement and other Chicano Power and Puerto Rican Power, other movements, were still either in the upswing or still pretty powerful. And May Day was this moment when the model of a single left, a single unified party or organization where everyone follows a single leadership and a single program started to give way to the model that we have now, which is a model of networked resistance, where we have a movement of movements. And that self-mobilizing energy is one of the things that I think is so extraordinary about the resistance that we're seeing now.
What's the main lesson you take from history? Direct action works?
Yeah, it's that protest works. It doesn't always work under all circumstances, but particularly when groups are willing to be bold in their tactics and persistent in their approach within the broad discipline of nonviolent action, but using the whole array of tactics, including the strongest ones. In those circumstances, movements win much more than when they rely solely on established channels of influence, like lobbying or calling their member of Congress. It's the movements that are willing to take risks and willing to do bold action over time that are the most successful.
Writer L.A. Kaufman, her new book is Direct Action, Protest and the Reinvention of American Radicalism. L.A., thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
The state of Maine has asked the federal government to allow the state to ban people from using food stamps to buy soda and candy. According to the U.S. Department of Agriculture, soft drinks make up about 5% of all food stamp purchases. Joining us with more on this is Mary Mayhew, Commissioner of Maine's Department of Health and Human Services. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you.
And why are you asking the federal government to do this?
This is so critically important in terms of our efforts to restore integrity to the food stamp program known as Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, both in terms of our efforts to support nutritional purchases, but certainly I also oversee our state's Medicaid program. And we today, both in the state of Maine and certainly across the country, are dealing with significant increases in obesity. There is a clear connection here, and we need to support nutritional purchases within the food stamp program.
But why single out the food stamp recipients and not just tax soda and candy the way that it worked with cigarettes?
It's really important, first of all, to establish that, again, the name of this program is the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. It is intended to support nutritional purchases. We shouldn't even need to debate whether soda and candy are nutritional. This is not only a recommendation from Maine's Department of Health and Human Services. The medical community has come out in support of these efforts. This is a common sense reform to the food stamp program.
But again, why not just tax these things so that everybody, because I assume that Maine's obesity problem is not limited to the people who are receiving food stamp assistance, that it goes across the board.
But in this case, we are talking about a taxpayer-funded program designed to support nutritional assistance for vulnerable families. How individuals who earn money for groceries choose to make those decisions around what they buy, that's their prerogative. But this is a program that should have common sense restrictions, and we should not be allowing a taxpayer-funded program to be used to purchase soda and candy. It clearly is not nutritional.
So should Social Security recipients also not be able to purchase soda and candy?
Well, I oversee the administration of the food stamp program. And so from my perspective and from the work that we're doing, this is a clear common sense reform for a program that is focused on providing nutritional assistance.
Now, this isn't the first time that Maine has requested this from the federal government. In 2015, the Obama administration denied a similar request. Do you think you'll be successful this time around under the Trump administration?
I am certainly optimistic that the Trump administration and the United States Department of Agriculture will take more seriously this waiver. Maine is not the only state that has requested this reform. I would imagine that there will be more requests of the Trump administration, and I am optimistic that they will agree with the state of Maine that this is a common sense reform. It's in the best interests of those who are receiving this supplemental nutrition assistance, and it will go a long way to also connecting the dots between not only this federally funded program, but the federally funded Medicaid program, where we are incurring significant medical costs caring for individuals with obesity.
So nobody's going to argue with your statement that these things are not nutritional. There's no question about it. Soda and candy are not nutritional. So why do you think that so many people who are on food stamps are using those food stamps to buy these things?
Because it's allowed. We know that based upon the report that was just released from the United States Department of Agriculture that 5% of the $70 billion being spent annually on a national basis on food stamps, and that translates into $13 million in Maine, is being spent on soda. This is a straightforward reform. Doesn't take a lot to simply ban soda and candy from this program.
One of the things that has been a challenge in the past is that people, especially people in poverty, don't have access to markets that sell fresh fruits and produce and more nutritional things. Is that a problem in Maine?
As we have examined the access, I am confident that there are adequate resources that can support. There are certainly opportunities both within the grocery stores, within the convenience stores, to improve access. That should be no reason, however, to justify in a supplemental nutrition assistance program the continued purchase of soda and candy.
That's Mary Mayhew, who is Commissioner of Maine's Department of Health and Human Services. Commissioner, thank you.
Thank you very much.
And you can weigh in at hereandnow.org. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Eric Westervelt. You're listening to Here and Now.